heresy.
All right, so the gospel reading is Matthew 22, beginning at verse 15. And it's interesting, I'm not sure of the historic lectionary connection between these two texts or if this is a recent thing, but there is sort of an interesting, if not immediately obvious, connection between Isaiah 45 and the text here, Matthew 22. This whole questioning of the Pharisees and the Herodians of Jesus. Now, a little bit of context and why things are put the way they are, always helpful to do in a narrative text, of course. In chapter 21, Jesus enters into Jerusalem, and so the point of conflict with the religious leaders is reaching its head. He's been acknowledged by the crowds out on the hillsides as the Son of David, and probably more significantly, so there's this obvious theme of Jesus' popularity with the common people, if you will. But more sort of immediately applicable or relevant to this text is at the end of chapter 21, where Jesus tells the parable of the wicked tenants. And rather strikingly, of course, the conclusion Jesus says in verse 43, on account of this I say to you that the kingdom of God will be taken from you and given to ethne, who are doing the fruit of it, who are doing its fruit. So to take the kingdom from you and to give it to the ethne, not a good thing. And so in verse 45, hearing the chief priests and the Pharisees knew his parable, that about him he said it. So he spoke this parable against them. And seeking him to arrest him, they feared the crowd. So they want to get rid of him already at the end of chapter 21. And so when they come approach him again in chapter 22, it's not with kind words or a sort of, hey, how's it going, Jesus? Let's kind of talk this over sort of thing. Maybe we can work it out. Okay. There's already this conflict set up. And so in 15 to 22, we have the questioning of the Pharisees and the Herodians. And then immediately following Pericope, 23 to 33, is the Sadducees. So all the religious leaders are now sort of ganging up on Jesus as the climax of the gospel reaches here to the point where he's going to be handed over into death. So beginning of verse 15 then. Tota poruthentis poi pharisaiois symbolion elabon hapas aton. And you had to look this one up. Pagadusosin en logo. Okay. Then approaching, journeying, right, porumai, participle there, aorist participle. The Pharisees, Elabon, another aorist here indicative, took symbolion, took counsel, hatched a plot, something like that. Help us how they might, and this pagaduo is an interesting verb, it only occurs here in the New Testament. In the Old Testament, it's used a few times in context of sort of hunting or trapping. So they're giving counsel how they might ensnare him, is maybe the way that goes, entrap him. A hunter seeking its prey, but doing so in a sort of hidden way. It's not like the hunter shows up with a shotgun or his Bowie knife and takes on the bear, but he sets a trap and goes and hides and waits for the bear to fall into it, kind of a thing. So anyway, how they might entrap him, and then in logo, not here in a word, meaning a vocable like we do in English with word, but by logos is utterance, in a statement, in an utterance or some sort of oral composition, oral statement. So trapping in his words, maybe is the way we say that in English, even though it's a singular. So verse 16, how do they do this? Kai apostelusin autotus mathetas auton. Metaton Herodion, sorry, Herodianon Legontes. All right, let's stop there. And they sent to him, just a present indicative there, their disciples with the Herodians. Now, it's really kind of an odd phrase there. If you look in your Nestle margin, you see the reference to Mark 3:6. Mark has the same two groups of people plotting against Jesus to kill him already in chapter 3. After the series of conflicts over the law in chapters 2 and 3 there in Mark. Here, Matthew has the same phrase, disciples of the Pharisees and the Herodians. Now, the Herodians are not a well-defined group. We're not exactly sure, you know, who these people are in terms of extra-biblical evidence. Obviously, there's a connection to Herod, and here the Herod on the throne would be Herod Antipas, not Herod the Great. The key thing here is two different groups of people with two sort of gripes against Jesus, or two potential gripes against Jesus. The Pharisees' concern is, how do we live as God's people in this situation where we don't have the Old Testament set up right? We don't have a king on the throne. We got this Greek temple that we're calling the Temple of Yahweh. It's a Greek building, you know, that Herod built for us. It's this bizarre situation that the Torah doesn't directly address. So how do we live as God's people in this present age? And so they're trying to apply the law in this new context. Okay, how do you live righteously in this new context? So what's proper behavior is a pretty key thing for the Pharisees. Herodians are not so concerned about the law, but they're concerned about keeping power. Because the Herodians got their power exclusively and only because they had connections in Rome. They were called kings, but that's not king in sort of a divine right, all authority kind of way. It's king in sort of a Rome will let you rule if you don't blow it too bad kind of way. And so their reign is directly dependent on connections in Rome. And so questions about Caesar, of course, would be very prominent for the Herodians. If there's trouble in their lands over allegiance to Caesar, that will reflect poorly upon them, and there's risk of losing their quote-unquote kingdom. Okay. So two very different sets of concerns that these two groups would have, and that's reflected in the response of Jesus. So they're asking the same question, but with two different sort of motives. So even putting these two together is rather striking. The fact that they're plotting the same thing for very different reasons is rather striking here. Everybody's ganging up on Jesus, in other words. So what do they ask? And this you just got to take with complete sarcasm and irony. All right. Didaskala oidamin hata alephes e kai ten hadan tu theu en alephia didaskes kai umele soi peri udinas. Right. So teacher, the vocative there from Didaskalos. Teacher, we know that you are alephes. Now here the noun is something more like genuine, maybe righteous is the word here. Not you are true sort of thing, like alephia, but you are sort of genuine. You're the real thing. You're pure, maybe is the way to say it. So either the present indicative of me is just a predicate construction. We know that you are pure. You are genuine. And the way or the road of God, the way of God, you are teaching, didaskes, the present indicative, you are teaching in truth. Here again, probably in a genuine, real, righteous kind of way. Right? So, you know, butter them up a little bit. And it is not concerned to you concerning, udinos here is from the days of the genitive, concerning anybody. Sort of an idiomatic phrase, something like, it doesn't matter to you who you're talking to. Right? It is not a concern to you concerning anyone. Right? You'll say the same thing because you're genuine. You'll say the same thing to one person that you say to another person. Okay. So the two halves of that little sentence are kind of saying the same thing. You're consistent. Doesn't matter who you're talking to or the context. You do the same thing. And then the last part of there, ugar blepes es prosopon anthropon. For you do not see or look upon the face of people. Again, it's sort of an idiom here. You don't look upon the face of a person. You look in the margin again, you see 1 Samuel 16. This is where David is surprised that he's going to be anointed. And Samuel says, you know, God doesn't consider appearances. So he can pick you, little runt guy, to be king, sort of thing. In English, we might say idiomatically, you know, you don't judge a book by its cover, is kind of what it's saying. You don't look at the outside. You don't look at the face. You know, you consider all people the same. Okay. So, nice preface. As soon as somebody is that nice to you, you probably know that they're going to, you know, turn the knife in a second here. So, verse 17. Epa un hemen, tisoi doke. Say therefore to us what it seems to you. So the impersonal dokeo, ti there is, with the accent, is the interrogative pronoun, neuter, what it seems to you. Epa, the aorist imperative. So say to us what it seems to you or how it looks to you. Exestin, or exestin, dinai, kainsan, kaisari, e-u. So is it permitted, is it lawful to give, dinai is the infinitive, aorist infinitive of didimi, and here it's a complementary construction, so with an impersonal verb like exesti, is it permitted to give, it's a complement to the verb. Sometimes it's also called an object used to the infinitive. Anyway, is it permitted to give a kainsis, and then kaisari in the dative, to Caesar, to the emperor, probably better here, or not? Now, what's rather critical is that they're asking about a kainsis. In Latin, the kensis, the census, is how it came over into the King James. The census was a particular type of tax. In Palestine, you had essentially three types of taxes. You had a land tax, which would be paid on your harvest if you were a landowner. There would be sort of duty taxes on imports or bringing things into the market, sort of a thing. All those were sort of, how would you say it, not obvious to the average person. Okay, you would end up paying for the tax when you bought the goods, but it's not like you paid it directly to Rome. You know, it's not like a sales tax added on top of your purchase kind of thing. It's just built into the cost of doing business. Okay, but the census tax was called a, you know, we call it a poll tax or a head tax. It was the yearly tax required for all people regardless. And there's some debate about actually who paid it, what age did you have to start paying it, did males and females pay it, it doesn't really matter. The point is this tax is paid not in kind of hidden ways as you buy goods, but in a direct way to Rome itself. So it was an obvious connection to the occupiers, to the Roman government, to the civil authorities in a very obvious way. So the Herodians, of course, would be very interested in this because this is what props up their government, you paying this tax. And the Sadducees are concerned, well, for different reasons, because as we'll see, you know, this thing about the image on the coin, we'll get to that in a second. So census here is pretty critical what kind of tax this is because of both the religious and political implications. So can you be a part of the kingdom of God in Pharisees' terms and still pay the tax is the question. Now, it's this would have been a rather pointed question given the context. Not only is the situation with the occupation sort of by the Romans going on here, but about 25 years before the time of Jesus here, in 6 AD, Simon the Galilean led a revolt because of the census tax. And actually, you know, got into armed conflict, you know, guerrilla warfare with the Roman government over this issue. So it's not sort of an idle question. If you don't pay the tax, there's potentially, you know, civil war going on here. And, of course, most people, A, are not happy about paying any taxes, but B, paying taxes to the occupier. So back earlier in chapter 1, when the Pharisees are afraid of the crowd, maybe here's a way to get the crowd away from Jesus if he tells them to pay taxes to Rome. So it's a kind of a sly move here. You kind of can't win, obviously, is the point of the Pharisees' question and the Herodians. They know what they're doing with this question. They gave counsel. They thought this through. They had a voters' meeting and came up with a plan, sort of a thing here. So Jesus, of course, sees through the trap here, verse 18. Gnus deho Jesus tein panerion auton epen. Knowing, there the aorist participle of gnosko, Jesus knowing the wickedness, their wickedness, literally, you know, their deceitfulness, maybe here is better, said, te me perazita hypocritai. Another interrogative indefinite pronoun here. Why do you test me, hypocrites? Or why are you testing me, hypocrites? Hypocrites here is not sort of inconsistent behavior, but evil behavior. Beneath the surface sort of behavior. So why are you testing me? Verse 19. Epidexita, or epidexite, moi ta namasmatu kensu. Epidexite is the aorist imperative of epidignumi. So show to me the coin of the census, the coin of the tax coin. Okay. So now he's actually asking for the coin itself. Right? What is the coin with which you pay the census, this particular kind of tax? And then, of course, the point of asking for the coin, this comes in verse 20, sorry. Hoide prosenenken enikon auto denarion, sorry. They brought to him, that's a weird-looking word from Prospero, heirs from Prospero. They brought to him the denarius. Okay, so the coin is called the denarius. So verse 20, I'll talk about what's on the coin in a second, because it comes up in verse 20 here. Kai lege autois, tenas e icon ate kai he epigraphe. He says to them, of whom is this image and thee or this inscription? So some nice kind of classic words here, right? Numismatics are coin collectors. Here it comes from the word here. And then epigraphic evidence is inscriptional evidence. So this is where all these words come over into English. Anyway, here's how he plays this. Of whom is the image and the inscription? Now, if you go to various commentaries, there's a little bit of debate about what exactly is on the coin. In fact, I went and punched into Google, denarius coin, Judea, whatever you type in kind of thing. And most sites will say something like, well, this coin had a picture of Julius Caesar or here Caesar, Tiberius Caesar at this point. And some kind of inscription that would typically say something like, the name, Tiberius Caesar, and then something like Filii Divi Augusti, so the divine or son of the divine Augustus, and that the beef Jesus would have, or the potential problem would be using a coin A that has an image of the emperor, which is against Jewish law, and B having that coin say he was a divine figure of some sort, son of a divine figure, Augustus. Now the problem with that connection is A, those coins only occur with Latin inscriptions, and it's extremely unlikely that you have Latin inscriptions in Palestine. No other coins from Palestine from this period have Latin inscriptions. Secondly, those coins are silver, and very unlikely you have silver denarii minted in Palestine. Probably a much lower valued coin. And what's more likely, given the evidence we have, if you do search a little bit further, is that you have the locally minted, Caesarea anyway, the locally minted currency coin, which wouldn't necessarily have the emperor. In fact, did not have the emperor on it, but had, I think it went off here. You can buy them if you want. the $150 for the good ones. The image, it is sort of the same issue, but not exactly kind of the picture of Caesar on it. The one side of the coin had the name Empress Julia, which is the mother of Tiberius, and the back side of the coin had of Tiberius Caesar, the genitive form just like you have here, of Tiberius. The images, and this is kind of interesting, I wonder if this might come into play. There's two coins minted during Pontius Pilate's period of governorship here. One of them has a vessel used in sacrifices, the libation bowl for wine sacrifices. Now, these are not used in Jewish practice. It's a Roman, even emperor worship system. And then on the back side, you have either the year of the reign or some sort of innocuous, like, barley grain, sheaves or something like that. Okay, but if they're in Greek, which matches a lot more with the Judean context, and you still have the religious connection, perhaps maybe a little more obviously here. Now, what's interesting is there's only a handful of these coins with that particular image, And what scholars have figured out is he switched this rather quickly, because you put a religious symbol on a coin that you're using in Judea, and you're going to tick some people off. So the next round of coins, which actually gets produced for several years afterward then, has sort of a curly staff on it. It's called a litus. And it was also used in some ritual, but it looked also like a shepherd's staff, sort of. So you can kind of get away with it. And it was less obviously a religious sort of a thing. So it might be actually kind of interesting if you could actually pay, because, you know, the scholars have dated this to apparently 29, when Pilate issued the first coin, and then late 29 and 30s following to the other coin. You know, if you kind of date Jesus about that time, maybe that's what's in the newspaper, you know. Do you use this coin with this obviously religious symbol on it, and it says it's of Caesar, sort of a thing. So, it might actually be sort of, you know, what's going on in the blogs, you know, that day or something. Both of which, by the way, would fit with this, what Jesus says. Of whom is the image in the inscription? And I think that the second coin actually works better, because the point is the inscription. It's not the image itself that's obvious, but when you say it's Caesaros, of Caesar, that becomes the problem. All right, anyway, so here's the coin. I should say, too, other coins that weren't used for the poll tax, just kind of for everyday commerce in Judea, didn't have any sort of religious association to it, or obvious Roman connection. In fact, many of them were minted with Hebrew letters, just to avoid offense. So it's probably more accurate in the second case here. Anyway, of whom is the image? Okay, verse 21. They say to him, Caesaros. And again, that's exactly the form of the word that's on the coin, Caesaros. Of Caesar, of the emperor, which fits grammatically, of course, but it is interesting, exactly the same thing. So they said to him, the emperors. Then he says to them, Tautologeotois, aparata un ta kaiseros, kaiseri, kai ta tu theu to theo. So here, apodata, the imperative aorist from apodidomi. And it's interesting here, give back. Right, apodidomi is to give back, not just to give, but give back, therefore, ta kaiseros, that's a neuter article here used as a pronoun, the things of Caesar, kaiseri to Caesar, or the things of the emperor to the emperor. It's got his name on it, you know, it says it belongs to him literally on the coin, so give it back to him. And this is key, at the same time, right, ta tu theu, the things of God to God. Now we'll talk about what all that means in a second here. We'll finish it off. 22, kai akousantes ephthalmason, kai aphentes aton apeothon. And hearing ephthalmason, here the heirs, they were, not the heirs, yeah, sorry, they were amazed. Amazed, not in the sense of, gee, isn't that an amazing answer, but amazed in a sense of surprised he wiggled out of it. Okay, would be sort of the amazement here. So Kai Aphentis, and leaving him, they went away. So a couple errors there. All right. Now, what do you do with this phrase? This has been a topic of much discussion, of course, in the history of the church. Tertullian, you know, talks about this passage and implications in his day. There's been varying interpretations throughout Christian history on the significance of this passage and what he means by things of Caesar to Caesar, things of God to God. You know, is he making a distinction? Is he putting one over the other, one under the other? A couple things are sort of critical in this. First of all, the context is in conflict. And it is something of an aphorism, you know, something of a nice pithy saying. And I don't want to say you downplay its significance, but you can't build a whole lot just off of this. You don't have a lot to go on here. And it is consistent with other statements in Scripture, like Isaiah 45, like Romans 13. But you sort of have to look elsewhere to flesh out what this means, okay? Which is, I think, why in the history of the church, people have come up with so many different interpretations because they read it just as, here's one sentence that defines the entire relation between church and state. Well, it's probably not the best way to do it. So what would you do with this, you know, in context as well as in context of the whole scriptures? I mean, first of all, it is rather interesting that this comes up, you know, just a few weeks before the election. And I will almost guarantee if you read this from the gospel, you know, on Sunday morning and then don't preach on it, people will think you're chicken. You know, and even, you know, Cyrus, you know, you want to preach a sermon on Cyrus, you know, maybe, you know, maybe Sarah Palin is Cyrus, who knows, you know, whatever. Anyway, have fun with that one. But what's actually his argument here? Within Matthew, it's actually pretty consistent with what he does in the Sermon on the Mount, right? So, where does it come from, and is it significant? Okay. Now, the things of Caesar here, you're talking about money, wealth. Well, he talked an awful lot about this in the Sermon on the Mount, right? Consider the lilies of the field, you know. Don't worry about what to eat or drink. You know, your Father in heaven knows you need these things, and he provides them to you, but seek first my kingdom, or his kingdom, and all these things will be added to you as well. Or seek first the kingdom of heaven. All right. So he's already talked about this, and made the point that money isn't the big deal. Okay, that's not the only question to be asked when dealing with questions of possessions, property, wealth. Okay, there's bigger questions involved, like one's relationship to God, and how one views wealth as a result. Secondly, he doesn't say don't pay the taxes, and this needs to be pointed out. Now, yeah, he's kind of playing the game here and getting out of this pickle he's in a sense, but he doesn't come up with an answer that would make it obvious that you're not supposed to pay the taxes. And so Paul in Romans 13 says pay taxes. It's entirely consistent with this. And apparently for Jesus, there's no disconnect between obligation to government and religious obligation. That those two are not necessarily antitheses or opposed to each other. That you can support government and support God at the same time. Now, it needs to be said that Jesus is not addressing situations where the government is not doing God's will. Okay. He's not answering again every question. That's not what's at issue here. He's simply saying it is not necessarily in conflict with following Yahweh or following God to pay taxes, and that fits with the New Testament. Just like it might be Cyrus who's God's agent, might have it. I guess we're running out of time. But this has to be understood within the second statement: what is from God, and that goes back to God. See. Now, it's all-inclusive. And even the government, as Paul says, there is no government or no authority that exists except that is what is from God. So even the government is seen within God's authority. And so obligation to the government is seen, in some sense, as obligation to God. It's consistent within that God works incarnationally even through governments. And so you can't always divide those two up. You know, even in times, as the Old Testament text said, in times of doing good and times of doing chaos, you know, doing peace and doing chaos. So political allegiance, even to a non-Christian state, which clearly is going on in Rome, obviously, is not incompatible with life in the kingdom. And so Jesus isn't a zealot. He's not a guy who wants to get rid of the Romans and saying you can't serve God and serve Rome at the same time. Second point needs to be made here is Jesus doesn't divide life into sacred and secular, but the secular is lived within the sacred. It's a subset within one's relationship to God. And so it's not serve God or serve country, it's serve God by serving country in this case. Which means that Christians have an obligation to serve government and to work to better government, I suppose, you could argue as well. So again, I said this doesn't address conflict, you know, between government and God's will, but at least says it's not necessarily inconsistent. And I think it's worth pointing out, maybe in our context today, where the political rhetoric just kind of ratchets up, and you know, on one side, you know, people are worried about having to move to Canada if the Republicans are reelected again, and And on the other side, people worry that the Supreme Court's going to throw everything to hell in a handbasket sort of thing if the Republicans are elected. God is still in control. And what Jesus is answering is, how does the individual follower relate to government? Not how does the church relate to the state or something like this. That's not the issue. But how do I, as one who follows Christ, relate to those who are placed in authority by God? And Jesus' point is, serve them. And it would be helpful here, I think, to unpack Romans 13 a little bit. I think that's pretty consistent with the Lutheran position, or the Lutheran position is consistent with Jesus, maybe is a better way to say it. That God acts both through the left hand and the right hand, and they're both God acting. And I think it's a healthy reminder for us that we can still serve God and serve our country no matter who's the president or who's the, you know, who we vote for. We could even have differing opinions politically and still both be serving God. So I'm out of time. I'll leave it at that. Any comments or observations?
After you shut it off.
After I shut it off. Good. I'll happily do that. Yeah.